A new political landscape in Texas? Not quite. On the day after the general election, what has changed, what hasn't, and why? That and much more today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. The dominant narrative in the run-up to Election Day was how an historic turnout in a state seldom considered in play in recent years might change the political map of the Lone Star State, notably the power of younger voters, the Latino vote, and the fight for the suburbs. Donald Trump's six-point margin of victory in Texas and Republican retention of control of the Texas House raise many questions about expectations and assumptions in the run-up. We'll explore and more when the National News Show of Texas gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this day after 2020. If you're asking day after what, you're just not paying attention. I'm David Brown. This was the year it was predicted when everything would change on the Texas political map. Remember? Wasn't that long ago, indeed hours ago, the possibility, nay, the likelihood that the long lines for early voting we saw in Texas, the record-setting numbers of young people and Latinos and college-educated suburbanites at the polls would finally show Texas's true colors, was the dominant narrative. It was projected we'd see a Texas more blue than red, or at the very least, purple. But looking at the Texas Tribune's county-by-county color map of the presidential returns, you'd have to be squinting pretty hard to miss the red sea. That's not to say there weren't Democratic gains or to dismiss the response of Democratic insiders like Ed Espinoza of Progress Texas, who notes that with every election, quoting here, we're getting one step closer to that change, close quote. But the familiarity of the refrain heard in 2014, 2016, 2018, and now 2020 is cause for pause. Not just for Democrats and Republicans, but for anyone interested in whether certain assumptions can get drowned out by the hoofbeats of a horse race. Pollster Nate Silver's 538 points to Starr County along the border, where 96% of the population is of Hispanic or Latino origin. It notes that Hillary Clinton won Starr County by about 60 points in 2016. This year, Joe Biden carried it by only 5. What, if anything, that says about the so-called emerging Democratic Party thesis, to say nothing of the larger Californiaization of Texas politics or the shifting suburbs narratives, are among the many matters worth considering on the morning after Election Day in Texas. For more on what all this means, Sharon Navarro. She is professor of political science at UT San Antonio. Professor Navarro, thanks for your time.
Good morning.
And we have Jim Riddlesberger joining us as well. He's professor of political science at Texas Christian University. Professor Riddlesberger, welcome back. And hopefully you can hear us there, Jim. We're going to be turning to you in just a moment. But first, Professor Navarro, the headline after Election Day in Texas, if I were writing it, might be turnout, turnout, turnout. How would you write that headline? What was the big story?
There was early excitement on in this election that occurred in early voting and mail-in ballot on Election Day. It was calm and the base of Republican Party turned out.
Yeah. Jim, tell me more about how you'd write that headline. Well, we don't have Jim, it appears. We're going to try to get him on in just a little bit. Oh, there we go. Here we go. Jim, how would you write the headline coming out of Election Day 2020 in Texas?
Well, I mean, I would say status quo. Slight movement, but status quo. Virtually every incumbent running for re-election at virtually every level won in Texas. So there's less news than that. I never thought that Texas was in play this year. I thought that it would close, and it did close. But it's still a Republican state.
I think the elephant in the room perhaps might be expectations, great expectations that certainly Democrats had. On Monday, the New York Times reported that there would have to be a polling error far beyond 2016 for President Trump to have a hope of winning the White House. And we know where we stand right now. After last night's massive polling failure, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post tweeted, "I'm going back to more tried and true methods like reading chicken entrails." Where do we stand with polls now? I want to first ask you, Sharon, where do you think that we are, and why is it that the polls don't seem to be giving us a clear indication, at least in the last couple of election cycles?
I think there's a lack of misunderstanding about Texas's political culture. We're a very conservative state. And if you want to understand how a state votes, you have to understand the individual state's electorate. And I think when you have polls out of New York and out of state who try to gauge a culture and a population that they don't understand, it creates difficulty. And the parties begin to follow those nationwide polls that don't really understand state politics, and we get a whole gamut of miscalculations and errors.
There was a lot of spending in this election cycle, more than $14 billion spent. It appears that the money was there for the Democrats, but that didn't translate into big margins and bigger wins, certainly not here in the Lone Star State. Why do you think that is, Professor Riddlesberger?
Well, of course, dollars don't vote. People do. And anytime that you forget that simple reality, you're going to miss the larger point. I think that there was success in advertising and spending. I think where the Democrats really failed this year was the lack of door-to-door canvassing that they've done in previous years because of the coronavirus. And I think that that really did hurt the Democratic Party more than it did the Republicans.
Professor Navarro, what do you think?
I have to agree. It was a late investment by the Democratic Party. The messaging was wrong. The micro-targeting was wrong at the end, and it really hurt. You have to go door-to-door.
It was interesting that the judge in Harris County was suggesting that Joe Biden needed to spend more time in Texas. That didn't materialize. In fact, it was something that the New York Times picked up on, noting that neither candidate really spent that much time in Texas. 38 electoral votes, and that could have, in fact, changed the national map if Texas had tilted that direction. Do you believe, Professor Navarro, that that could have made more of a difference for Democrats if Joe Biden had spent more time in the Lone Star State?
If he had started early and invested more time, people on the ground, perhaps so. But we're a very entrenched red state. So that would, it's a large state. It's a very expensive state. So a lot of investment would have to have occurred for Democrats to pull it off.
You know, I know that's that seems to be the conventional wisdom. And yet you think about, say, that sprawling 23rd congressional district where Congressman Will Hurd, Republican, a moderate Republican, I think most people would acknowledge, had a lot of trouble hanging on to his seat. He is retiring. Right now we have the Republican in that race, Tony Gonzalez, declaring victory. Is there something that's happening along the border that perhaps the mainstream media isn't picking up on? And I want to throw that to you, Professor Riddlesberger.
The short answer to that question is yes. But remember that Will Hurd was a unlike person even in that district. He won that district, but that is a largely Latino district. The Republican candidate, Gonzalez, is obviously resonated with some of this. And I think this goes back to some of the things that Professor Navarro was talking about. I mean, we need to concentrate on local issues and local climate in terms of understanding the behavior. The other mistake that we make with Latinos is throwing them all in one basket as if they are one set of voters, when in fact it's a very diverse set of voters. One of the things that we don't talk about, for example, is the number of Latinos who are Pentecostal and very conservative in their religious beliefs. And so for them, the issue of abortion is the driving issue that determines everything that they do. And of course, that limits the success that Democrats are going to have with voters who are one issue voters on the issue of abortion.
But I think it's important, again, to point out, as you just did, that no voting bloc is monolithic, certainly not the Latino voting bloc in Texas. And that may be one of the takeaways from this election cycle. But I want to turn to another part of this narrative, and that is the battleground suburbs. Now, we did see some interesting things happening, especially around Austin. Williamson County and Hays County, both on the periphery of both bordering Travis County, of course. Both of those counties went to Joe Biden. You don't see a lot of that if you look at that Texas map. Around Dallas County, for example, it was especially close, however, in Tarrant County. And I'm curious what either of you make of that. Was there, in fact, a battleground suburbs in Texas, or did it just happen to tip narrowly to Trump this go-round?
I mean, political change in Texas and elsewhere is incremental in its nature. That is to say, you shouldn't assume that there is going to be this kind of 30 or 40 point swing that some commentators were looking at. What we saw was a fairly significant swing. The suburban voters in Texas have been the core of the Republican Party in Texas for years and years and years, and that's no longer the case. The Republicans cannot take the suburbs for granted anymore, and I think we're going to continue to see movement in the suburbs towards being more purple.
Professor Navarro, you think about the combination of things, though. You have the pandemic. You have the Trump effect. A lot of pushback there, especially among college-educated suburbanites. You think about the voting turnout here. There are so many factors that would seem to be leaning in the direction of Democrats. And I'm curious, if this were not the year for there to be a tipping point, what would it take, do you think, Professor Navarro?
It would take a lot of investment from the Democrats to really change the state of Texas. We're deeply conservative, and as you know, it's been said before, we have incremental change. So a lot of investment. I don't think you're going to see that from the Democratic Party. They consistently say that every presidential election, and it's simply not the case.
Investment? Is it the money that's missing, or is it where that money is placed? I'm curious that we've seen in recent election cycles, Professor Riddlesberger, an influx of cash there at election time. But prior to that, where is that spending?
Well,
do you think that's...
I mean, part of this is the perverse incentives that the Electoral College gives us. I mean, the truth is that the reason that Joe Biden didn't come to Texas is he didn't need Texas to win. And the reason Trump didn't go come to Texas is he just assumed he was going to win Texas because without Texas, he couldn't win. So the result is that they didn't come at all. They threw a little bit of money on the wall, but they really didn't engage in any kind of coordinated effort to win in Texas. And that is, that just signals the perverse incentives. The fact that the three largest states in our country, New York, California, and Texas were ignored by presidential candidates suggests a problem that the Electoral College really does give us.
Jim Riddlesberger is a professor of political science at TCU. Sharon Navarro, professor of political science at UT San Antonio. Let's quickly turn to Wells Dunbar. He is our social media editor. Wells, what's the talk of Texas?
Well, David, we're hearing about that decidedly less than stellar showing for Texas Democrats on our Facebook page. Plenty of comments coming in there and Twitter both, but I will be back with all of those comments and more later in the show. So much to talk about today, David.
Yeah, we need to hear from you, Texas. Look for us on your social media platform of choice. Just look for Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed Podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Though he wasn't on the ballot, Governor Greg Abbott wasn't sitting on the sidelines this general election. In fact, he spent a lot of his own money and went knocking on doors over the last few weeks as Democrats took aim at flipping the Texas House, pouring money into several races. They needed 9 seats to gain control, but fell short. KERA's Mallory Falk reports.
It would be the biggest political shakeup in Texas in nearly 2 decades, snapping Republicans' long control of the House, Senate, and governor's office. And it seemed like it might be within reach. Democrats needed to hold the 12 seats they picked up in 2018 and win 9 more. They poured money into races around the state.
Democrats gave it a really good try.
Mark Jones is a professor of political science at Rice University.
The difficulty is they're still in a Republican state, and a majority of the voters in many of these districts are still Republican-leaning.
Jones says some of those Republicans did vote for a Democrat, Joe Biden. But when it came to down-ballot races,
they went back to their true roots and voted for the Republican candidate.
Ultimately, as returns came in, Democrats were at least a few seats short of turning the House blue. Jones says the outcome will have long-term implications, since next year is a redistricting year when state lawmakers redraw district lines for seats in Congress and the state legislature. If the House flipped and the legislative chambers were divided and the redistricting process gridlocked, the courts could end up redrawing those lines. But with Republicans controlling both the Senate and House,
they'll be able to draw tailor-made districts to maximize the number of Republicans who are elected.
For that reason, he says, this election might have been Democrats' best chance to flip the House for a while. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
The Texas Standard's own Michael Marks has been monitoring the numbers in the Lone Star State since the polls closed last night. Michael, what races have you been taking special note of?
Well, David, taking a look at the U.S. House races, some more clarity here. I should say from the outset, I have a lot of what to bring you. I don't have a lot of why or how just yet. But Democrats thought that they might be able to flip some seats and gain a bigger share of the state's congressional delegation. That has not happened. A couple races in particular I want to point out. A little more detail on a race you touched on at the top of the show, Texas 23. That's the big district, literally, that stretches from San Antonio to El Paso. You know, it's traditionally very tight. It has flipped back and forth between Republicans and Democrats. Will Hurd, a Republican, held it for the last few terms. Republican Tony Gonzalez won, as we heard, beating Gina Ortiz-Jones by 4 percentage points. That sounds tight, and it is, but it's actually the widest margin of victory for the district since 2012. Remember, that came absolutely down to the wire in 2018. Also wanted to bring up Texas's 15th district, David. That runs just east from San Antonio, all the way down to the Rio Grande Valley, includes places like McAllen and Edinburgh. The incumbent here is a Democrat, Vicente Gonzalez, running for his third term, and he won. But he won by about 2.5 percentage points, according to the most recent numbers from the Texas Secretary of State's office. What's notable here, David, in 2018 and 2016, Gonzalez won that district by 20 percentage points over his Republican challenger. About 60,000 more people voted in the district in 2020 versus 2018, and about two-thirds of those appear to be Republicans. So pretty notable there. Also, David, just real quick, we're still waiting for the Associated Press to call Texas 24. That's in the Dallas-Fort Worth suburbs. That's an open seat. Representative Kenny Marchant is retiring. Republican Beth Van Dyne, a former mayor of Irving, has about a 1% lead over Democrat Candace Valenzuela, who served on a local school board. Van Dyne has declared victory in the race. But again, no call yet from the Associated Press.
I see. Now, did you mention U.S. House District 21 yet, Chip Roy?
I did not, but it appears that Chip Roy in that district that extends from Austin out to the Hill Country has defeated former State Senator Wendy Davis, the Democrat in that race.
Yeah, that's a race closely watched in large part because of Wendy Davis's name recognition.
Correct.
There. We recall she ran for governor in a much closely watched race a couple of election cycles back. I don't think, have mentioned the U.S. Senate race. That was called fairly early, right? We have John Cornyn, the incumbent, beating Mary M.J. Hagar, 53.7% to 43.7%.
That's correct. That was called fairly early in the evening, David. And it's interesting, not unlike the Beto O'Rourke, Greg Abbott voter that we saw a couple of years ago, there appear to be a fairly robust number of John Cornyn, Joe Biden voters in the state of Texas.
Very interesting. Michael Marks is doing the numbers for us, and he will continue to do so. There's more of the Texas Standard ahead. Stay with us.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. For months now, Election Day has been the end, the deadline, it. So what now? We wait for official results from the presidential contest, but the work is far from over and will persist long after the last vote is counted, says commentator Peniel Joseph.
This year of pandemic and anti-racist protest has revealed to the world both the grandeur and the challenges of American democracy. Movements for racial equality, economic opportunity, and intersectional justice have galvanized historic numbers of Americans to demonstrate in the streets. Ideas of social and political change no doubt also contributed to the record voter turnout in Texas. The COVID-19 pandemic exposed racial, economic, and gender fault lines within our national American family that must be transformed in order to build a healthy and truly equitable democracy. Food justice, housing affordability, quality public schools, and racially integrated neighborhoods help families, communities, and democracy to thrive. Our collective voices matter now more than ever. Racial justice, as demonstrated by the George Floyd protest, remains key to reimagining systems of punishment, structural violence, and systemic racism that impoverish and marginalize millions of people while making our democracy weaker. Voter suppression in the form of long lines, distant polling locations, and ID standards that are specifically designed to discourage Black, Indigenous people of color diminish the legitimacy of our democratic processes and the long-term viability of our institutions. Democracy only works if we are willing to engage with our friends, neighbors, and adversaries in the hard work of discussion, debate, organizing, and compromise in order to build consensus around how we define citizenship and dignity for all people. We can choose to reimagine public safety, advocate racially justice-centered environmental policies, and build a beloved community free of racism, violence, segregation, and poverty. Election matters, and so does the work that follows. Now is our chance in Texas and around the country to begin the work of democratic renewal and community building in service of the larger cause of justice. Come, let us build a new world together.
The comments of Peniel Joseph, who's the Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He's also a professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas at Austin. Your comments? Share them with us. Texas Standard at KUT.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Dallas Democrat Krista Castaneda is conceding this morning to Republican Jim Wright in their race for the Texas Railroad Commission. Wright owns an oil field waste services company. His victory last night maintains total Republican control of the three-member state agency that regulates the oil and gas industry. Last night, Castaneda, an oil industry engineer and attorney, vowed to continue to fight for stronger environmental protections.
We got a lot of work to do to get oil and gas and the emissions from the oil and gas economy reined in, but we can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Wright replaces Ryan Sitton, who lost his reelection bid for a seat on the commission in the Republican primary. A central Texas county that saw record-breaking voter turnout has elected its first Democratic sheriff in decades. Robert Schody, the Republican incumbent, lost his reelection bid in Williamson County last night. KUT's Allison Ortegon reports on the controversies that surrounded Schody's bid for a second term.
First, let me introduce you to the sheriff-elect. Mike Gleason retired from the Williamson County Sheriff's Department in 2016 after serving in various positions over 24 years. One thing that helped Gleason win the election was the cloud of controversy that surrounded Schody. He ran his reelection campaign in the midst of investigations and an indictment from a Williamson County grand jury over the death of Javier Ambler. Ambler died in deputies' custody last year. Schody's trial for an evidence tampering charge is set for later this month.
Allison Ortegon reporting. A district court hearing is underway on the shutdown order El Paso County Judge Ricardo Samaniego issued late last month. He's directed all non-essential businesses to close for 2 weeks to reduce the spread of the coronavirus. A group of restaurants and Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton are trying to halt the measure, arguing it conflicts with Governor Greg Abbott's order to reopen businesses. Today's hearing comes the same day El Paso is reporting a new daily record of 3,100 COVID-19 cases. And Houston-based Cisco is reporting a 23% drop in global sales for the first quarter of fiscal year 2021. On a conference call Tuesday, CEO Kevin Hourican said statewide shutdowns have taken a toll on the company's restaurant supply operations.
Our southern states and our rural geographies are performing quite well, substantially better than the national average. The major urban centers, California as a state, are struggling, and it's directly tied to the restrictions that are being placed on operators.
The world's largest food service distributor laid off or furloughed roughly a third of its workforce at the start of the pandemic. I'm Joseph Leahy.
As communities grapple with the coronavirus pandemic, new developments unfold continuously. Catch up on the day's news from around the world and across Texas by listening to All Things Considered, weekday afternoons on your local NPR station.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. As election night numbers continue to be tallied, sifted, and evaluated, there are some patterns here that are starting to take shape, especially coming from Latino voters. For more on this, we turn to Richard Pineda in El Paso. He's the director of the Sam Donaldson Center for Communication at the University of Texas, El Paso. Professor Pineda, how are you doing this morning?
Well, I'm a little bit tired, David, but no worse for wear.
I figured you might have been up late last night. One of the things exit polls seem to be showing is that President Trump picked up support from Latino voters overall this election. And I think that's something that has surprised some election watchers. How did this play out in Texas?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a difference. I mean, I think people are going to point to Florida today and say the president made big inroads with the Cuban community, the Venezuelan community. Mm-hmm. I think that's tied very specifically to a sense of countering support for those governments. And I think that's still a big issue. I think what we're going to look at in Texas, especially when you look at the metropolitan areas, I think the immigration strategy which the president has pursued, that I think a lot of people, especially Democrats, have been sort of aghast at, I think has actually played to the strength of winning over Mexican-American voters in Texas in particular. I think that it has drawn a bright line for the administration to point to newcomers to the state and newcomers to the United States and say, mm-hmm. listen, those people are coming and they're going to be a threat to what you have accomplished so far. I think that's resonated, and I don't think that the Democrats hedged on the kind of impact that would have. I think that the Democrats assumed that people would, be aghast at these images of child separation and the asylum seekers, and I don't think that that exactly played out that way, David. I think there are a lot of second and third generation immigrants that say, that's right, we came here the, quote-unquote, right way, and now we have carte blanche to be unhappy or upset at those people that are coming now.
Do you think that this accounts for what happened in Starr County? I was talking about earlier in the broadcast, 96% of the population is Hispanic or Latino, and Hillary Clinton won Starr County by 60 points in 2016. This year, Joe Biden carried it by only 5. That's quite a change, it would appear, on the surface. What do you make of it?
I think some part of that is exactly the thing that former Congressman Beto O'Rourke had been saying now for a couple of weeks, which is that Biden needed to come to Texas and he needed to be here, not with the same regularity as a battleground, but that could have changed the conversation. I think the other thing, and this is the big picture for Democrats in Texas, David, is that they mm-hmm. need to really think about pushing Mexican-American candidates and really changing the landscape. Because I think what the Republicans have managed to do in certain places is use the rhetoric of fear and the rhetoric of economic prosperity. The Democrats can't counter that until they start putting up legitimate candidates, legitimate Mexican-American or Latino candidates that have the backing of the party. I think otherwise it's going to come off as tone deaf and without the muscle to actually make change.
Something we can't overlook is the pandemic's impact on the Latino community, a higher death toll, a higher number of cases, the Trump administration's response. How did that resonate as a campaign issue? And do you think it might have in some way been the case that many Latino voters dealing with the virus at such disproportionate rates, they have perhaps other pressing issues to worry about than presidential race?
Well, I'll tell you, I think, El Paso County is a little bit of an outlier for the rest of the state in the sense that I think COVID was a huge issue for the incumbent mayor here. He is going into a runoff today with 24% of the vote. I think
and he's a Republican, COVID, we should point out as well.
Yeah, that's right, although it's a nonpartisan race. But I think in a place like El Paso, that resonated. I do believe that that was the major issue that undercut his campaign. Statewide, it's really hard to pull out exactly what happened. My sense is that you're right, that there are a lot of concerns that are tied to the broader economy. And remember, David, that when we're talking shutdown, the people that are most likely to be affected by that are people in retail and in the food service. And that speaks to a large portion of the Mexican-American and Latino population in Texas. And so if you're talking about livelihood versus threat, as horrible as the threat of the pandemic is, I mean, I think livelihood is on the line. And I think there are folks that are willing to take that risk if it means that they're going to have a paycheck at the end of the month.
In the couple of seconds we have left, you think Democrats and Republicans, how does this change their efforts toward trying to activate the Latino vote in Texas further?
I think that Texas Democrats need to seriously think about how they want to set up candidates, and they need to think about candidates that are in a stepped process. So it's not just that you're going to pop somebody to run for the U.S. Senate. You need to start cultivating.
Yeah. Richard Pineda is the director of the Sam Donaldson Center for Communication, University of Texas at El Paso. Thanks again, Professor.
You're welcome, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, who recognize the role caregivers play in helping patients fight cancer. With more than 200 locations, Texas Oncology and caregivers can be right here for cancer patients. More at texasoncology.com.
Is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Painters and stagehands, musicians and marketing professionals, more than 1.4 million people in America's cultural sector have lost their jobs because of COVID. KERA's Jerome Weeks looks into how some Texas artists are surviving and who's trying to help.
Rob Bosquez of Fort Worth has been working as a playwright, teacher, and bartender. In the spring, when schools, theaters, and bars closed, he lost all three of his paychecks.
Everything stopped. And so I was pretty much without any income. Yeah, I was just really out of luck.
Many writers, dancers, and designers splice together their income from multiple gigs like this. And many typically work in the hard-hit service sector, which has amplified the financial damage to the culture industry. Bosquez eventually got grants from two new sources. $250 from Southside Cares, which was set up quickly to help unemployed food service workers in Fort Worth's near Southside neighborhood. And $250 from the Live Theater League of Tarrant County. Joe Brown, the league's president, says they've never given grants before.
We had a nest egg that was raised probably over 15 years ago, and so we've been sitting on that and talking about ways we need to use this.
Now, $500 total in one-time aid may not seem like much. Many artists have been unemployed since April, but Bosquez says it came at a crucial time. Besides,
what was really encouraging was just knowing there was this community watching out for people that just had no income, people in the performing arts, people in the restaurant business.
Two other funding efforts in Fort Worth were started by the Fine Line Group, the office of Sasha and Edward Bass of the wealthy Bass family. One is Sounds of Resilience, which will direct thousands of dollars to songwriters and musicians. The other is the New Normal, which has already awarded grants to 43 visual artists.
Most of my income came from doing posters for bands and venues.
Xavier Walker was a freelance graphic artist. In March, all of his jobs got put off for just a few weeks.
And then it turned into months, and then it turned into indefinitely.
But among North Texas' many out-of-work artists, Walker got lucky. A $2,000 grant from the New Normal kept him afloat until he was hired as a full-time creative director.
This grant helped me help others. And after giving, I saw more doors opening for me. So I feel like it's cyclical. When you can give, you end up getting.
In response to the COVID crisis, established arts funders in North Texas, like the Arts Community Alliance, or TACA, and the Moody Fund for the Arts, either sped up their grant giving or increased the money amounts. Kateri Kale leads Echo Theater, which is dedicated to staging plays by women. Echo received support from both TACA and the Moody Fund.
Echo is small enough and nimble enough, and we didn't owe a whole lot of people. So with the emergency funds that we were able to get, it let us start some new initiatives.
Echo launched a podcast and is working on streaming a play. For the first time, the company is also paying Kale and her assistant small monthly stipends.
There are those bright spots out there. I wish there were more of them.
Zani Voss is director of SMU Data Arts. She says arts groups have certainly been innovative with drive-ins and online projects. But some COVID cancellations now extend into next summer. Back in May, Voss predicted a nearly $7 billion loss to America's art sector. Today, she'd more than double that to $15 billion.
It's going to be an incredible talent drain as people scramble to find what else can they do to feed their families.
The biggest local arts groups, Dallas Museum of Art, Dallas Symphony, Perot Museum, received more than $1 million each from the Federal Payroll Protection Program. Even so, most have had to cut their offerings or furlough staff. Voss says they're in the same boat as thousands of for-profit businesses. They're hoping a second federal lifeline will keep them afloat. As for Bosquez, the Fort Worth playwright, teacher, and bartender, he's teaching a bit.
I'm lucky enough to have a few organizations actually doing classes right now. But yeah, once these little gigs dry up, the future is very unpredictable.
Voss says the huge loss in revenue is what has damaged the arts so far. Now, it's the weariness and confusion over whatever happens next. I'm Jerome Weeks in Dallas.
The Fred Hartman Bridge is both the longest and the tallest bridge in Texas, but it's not the highest. That honor goes to the aptly named Pecos High Bridge. It's about as high as a football field, straight up. The claim to have the highest bridge in America may belong to Colorado, but commentator W.F. Strong says that's thanks to some Texas foresight and ingenuity.
The Royal Gorge Bridge was the dream of Lon P. Piper of San Antonio. They say he stood on the edge of the gorge in 1928 and imagined laying a bridge across it, a suspension bridge. He had already built a bridge across the Rio Grande in New Mexico. The Royal Gorge Bridge would be different, though. It would be a bridge to nowhere, one that would exist purely to give tourists the kind of heart-stopping views they couldn't get anywhere else in the world. He knew it would be a challenge, but he was certain it could be done. Within 2 years, he made his dream come true. It cost him $350,000, or $5 million in today's dollars, but when it was finished, he owned the highest bridge in the world, and it would remain so for 72 years. Lon was quite the entrepreneur in those times. He also developed the Richland Springs Treasure Cave in San Saba as a Carlsbad Caverns-like tourist attraction in the 1920s and 30s. He was also an early investor in a new concept of motor hotels called motels. Lon hired bridge engineer George Cole of Houston to design the Royal Gorge Bridge and to serve as the general contractor as well. With 70 men, they completed the project in 6 months, without a fatality or any serious injuries. It was a bridge built by Texans in Colorado that spanned the Arkansas River using Oregon timber for the deck. That's some interstate diversity in one bridge. Mr. Cole went on to design and build the narrow gauge railroad that would take brave riders to the bottom of the gorge at a 45-degree angle. Now there are gondolas far above the gorge for those who want to go higher still, and zip lines for those who can't get enough tachycardia in their lives. In 1947, Lon sold the bridge to another Texan, Clint Murchison Sr. Murchison bought it sight unseen, as an investment, and strangely, never traveled there to walk across his magnificent possession. He never stood at the precipice of the gorge to admire the highest bridge in the world that he just happened to own. Makes me think of what Fitzgerald said, "The rich are different from you and me." No, Murchison just set up the Royal Gorge Bridge Company and based it in Dallas to manage the Colorado property from there. When he died, the bridge was passed on to his sons, Clint Murchison Jr., you remember him, he founded and owned the Dallas Cowboys for 25 years, and his brother John. When John Murchison died, his wife Lucille inherited the bridge, and they say she loved it. She traveled up there to see it several times a year. For the past 20 years, the Royal Gorge Bridge's general manager of operations has been Mike Mandera, a Texan who got his start in the amusement park business at Six Flags Over Texas, where he worked for 16 years. So I'd like to say this to Colorado about the world-class bridge that we envisioned, financed, built, and managed for all these years. You're welcome. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F. Strong is a Fulbright Scholar and Professor of Culture and Communication at the University of Texas, RGV. You can check out more of his stories from Texas at texasstandard.org and wherever fine podcasts are served.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Results are continuing to trickle in from some races in Texas, but for many, a clear winner is already apparent. Here for an update on what we know so far, what we're still watching too, Brandon Rodinghouse. He's professor of political science at the University of Houston. Brandon, welcome back to the Standard.
Thanks, David.
We've talked quite a bit this morning about how the political map in Texas has not dramatically changed. This after historic turnout in Texas. What is the takeaway for you?
I think for one thing, that the nationalization of the race in this case was a negative for Democrats. It was a positive in 2018 when Democrats could tie Republicans down ballot to an unpopular Donald Trump. But this time, Democrats were tied to unpopular ideas from the National Democratic Party. And although local Democrats didn't spend that much time talking about it, it definitely, I think, drug them down. That, and to some degree, the trigger was for a lot of folks in suburban areas, the Joe Biden's comments about the oil and gas industry. That was really a problem, I think, for a lot of swing districts in suburban areas, especially here in Houston.
You're going to have to say more about what was happening at the national level for Democrats, because I think a lot of the conversation centered around how the race at the national level would help Texas Democrats, especially if you're looking at a certain Donald Trump.
I think that was the expectation, yeah. And Donald Trump's numbers were significantly lower than we saw in 2016 and frankly slumped, you know, with respect to the coronavirus too. What's interesting is that this is really a kind of a longstanding change. I think that you see the Democrats really trying to fight to get sort of Trump connected to every element of what Republicans are doing, but it didn't really work. In fact, looking just some of the numbers preliminarily, Donald Trump's numbers were not as good as they were for local Republicans. So Donald Trump may not have been very popular, but the Republican brand is still pretty popular down ballot.
Well, that sort of got me thinking now. This was the first general election in Texas, and certainly in recent memory, in which we didn't have straight ticket balloting. How much would things have been different, do you think, perhaps, if that had been in play?
I think it'd be a little bit different. I think you'd certainly see a stronger tie between the Republicans at the top of the ballot and the bottom of the ballot. But Donald Trump was getting beaten down ballot in most major counties by candidates who were running for Supreme Court and who were running for tax assessor collectors. So there was a lot of action down ballot that was directly resulting from the fact that Republicans have built a strong brand. I mean, they really do, I think, have a strong ground game. They were able to pivot from what happened in 2018 and steer into the skid to be able to give them a chance to fight for their future. And so I didn't view this really as a problem for Democrats. It wasn't a failure for Democrats. It was a success for Republicans.
Going into Election Day, a big part of the story was that this was a tight race in Texas. And yet polls on Texas and nationwide appeared to be dramatically off the mark. And I know a lot of listeners are wondering, how did that happen? And why, again, do we trust the polls anymore? Do they serve a purpose at this juncture? How do you read that?
Yeah, polls are really sort of part art and part science. I mean, the science part is just the sort of modeling to figure out, you know, who is likely to vote. And that's part of the artistry as well, is trying to expect what's to come in a changing electorate. The expectations were that you'd see shifting of suburban areas to the Democrats. That didn't happen in big numbers. You expected to see a rising Latino vote. That didn't happen in big numbers. It's hard to model a moving target. So for pollsters, it's a bit of a challenge. The other issue is, I think, too, that there are still significant numbers of people who are unwilling to give their true opinion. I think that polarization in this country has kind of come to the point where we're reluctant to talk about it. And that leads into when pollsters call. So I think that's a real challenge for pollsters to have to figure out.
Brandon Rodinghouse is professor of political science at the University of Houston. Professor Rodinghouse, thanks again for speaking with us. I know it's been a long night. We certainly do appreciate your expertise.
My pleasure, David.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar, I bet you it's been a long night for you too. You were probably up fielding the talk of Texas throughout the evening. What are you seeing
pizza,
out there?
You know, the whole nine.
Yeah. Oh, I know how that works. Yeah. So yeah, what are folks talking about across the Lone Star State?
Well, you know, obviously the big chatter still about the big unknown out there waiting for a definitive result in the presidential race. But lots of talk about, what appears to be the dashed hopes of Texas Democrats, what with just these conditions, this election, and that real concerted push they were making, not seeing any major gains there, not seeing the Texas House flipping, etc. Via Facebook, Craig Anders York says their hopes weren't dashed, but merely delayed. Jeff Baker says, spoiler alert, a massive GOP voter suppression effort seems to be paying off. I think referring there to some of that back and forth over early voting procedures and whatnot. Interesting perspective here via Twitter from Deborah Angel Smith. She says, doing the responsible thing, like not holding in-person rallies and block walking during a pandemic, appears to have crushed Democrats' hopes of sweeping change. And speaking to, one of the big sort of takeaways this morning, Jose Fonseca via Facebook, he says that Democrats are taking the Latino vote for granted. Just look at Zapata County. I think that's one of those counties where we saw that huge difference between, say, for instance, what Hillary Clinton did in 2016 and what Joe Biden did last night. He says, we are not monolithic and we are not a guaranteed vote. Biden could have won Florida. He could have made Georgia easier. He adds that when you forget the Latino vote, you get the results you deserve. And meanwhile, a slightly more optimistic take here via Twitter from Ada Mama. She says, why are you talking about like this is a major loss for Dems? The votes are still being counted. And I think referring there, obviously, to the national vote there. But hearkening back to what we just said, those really stunning turnout numbers, particularly in the Rio Grande Valley, in these majority Latino communities, really not bringing the results that Joe Biden wanted to see last night. I think we're going to be talking about that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You mentioned Zapata County in South Texas. It appears that a lot of folks voted for President Trump, but decided to vote for MJ Hager and not John Cornyn. Mm-hmm. So some interesting dynamics to be sorted through, especially in the border region, the RGV. We have not heard the last of this story, and it plays such an important part of the dynamics of Texas politics.
Yeah, so many wild cards this election. Obviously, the pandemic. I'm curious myself about the death of straight ticket voting and the impact that may have played there. This being the first presidential election in Texas without straight ticket voting. Obviously, at the national level, still waiting for things to shake out here. Obviously, looking at those big swing states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, going to be definitely key to a Biden victory. Should a Biden victory occur. Twitter, of course, being the prominent, how should I describe it? Soapbox, I guess you could say, of President Trump. President Trump taking to Twitter, casting doubt, aspersions without any evidence, I should hasten to add, on the vote count. Twitter putting these disclaimers that we see from time to time up on some of the president's tweets, warning that they are misleading. So obviously, this one's not settled yet, but I don't think we really anticipated it being settled very quickly.
I think that's probably true. Yeah. We'd love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. We're out of time for the big broadcast. The news continues at texasstandard.org, and we'll be back here tomorrow. Hope you can join us.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.